We don't ask you to believe anything that you hear tonight. In fact, if you go back to the other slide, John, this topic really isn't what we're going to talk about tonight. But we're going to talk about what really didn't happen, okay? And like I said, we don't ask you to believe what we're saying, but we would ask you that you have an open mind. And we as Americans have had it so good for so long that we cannot comprehend that there are actual people out there that are narcissists, that are megalomaniacs, that are egomaniacs, psychopaths, that we can't even comprehend because we're not like that. You're not like that. Your neighbors aren't like that. I'm not like that. My neighbors aren't like that. And so because of that, we have a hard time comprehending evil. But evil is real, let me tell you. It is very real. How many of you believe that Jeffrey Dahmer, when he killed all those little boys and put them in his basement and whatever else he did with them, how many of you believe that didn't really happen? Well, all of his neighbors didn't think it happened. They couldn't comprehend. Mr. Dahmer, well, he dresses nice in a suit all the time. He's nice and friendly to the people and never heard a bad word out of his mouth. And do you see what I'm saying? So what we suffer from as Americans, especially Americans, I guess it's human nature in general, is from a cognitive dissonance when it comes to this kind of stuff. It's called mass Stockholm syndrome, where we actually believe that, our government could never lie to us. They're the good guys. We elected them. Right? That kind of thing. And if you mention that to some of your friends and neighbors, they'll look at you like you have horns on your heads, that it's an impossibility. Yeah, they're stupid. Well, yeah, they do bad things. Oh, they make mistakes. They're incompetent. But they would never believe, or it's hard for them to believe, and some of you in here tonight, it may be hard for you to believe, that there is an agenda. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later on. So Stockholm syndrome, cognitive dissonance, and learned helplessness, some of these terms you may have heard before. So all we would ask you tonight is when you're done, when you go home, is to study, investigate, challenge. We challenge you to look up some of these things. Google it. We're not afraid. The truth will come out. The truth is coming out. The truth is out. Whether you want to see it or not, whether you want to accept it or not, that's up to you. That's between you and God. Okay? And Hosea 4, chapter 4 says, my people perish for lack of knowledge. You got that. Okay, what's the second line say? Anybody? It says, because thou hast rejected knowledge, I shall also reject thee. Okay? So which side are we on, ladies and gentlemen? And I'm not up here to preach to you, okay? I'm not a preacher, although I think if I was an LDS, I probably would have had that as my vocation because I think I can do a pretty good job at it sometimes. But point being is that I'm not Stephen Jones. We're going to show you some evidence, and we're going to show you some things that he would have shown you and told you had he been here. And believe me, it threw us for a curve on Monday evening when we got that email. And so we were kind of scrambling to put this together here for you at the last minute, if you will. But hopefully, I think you'll be pleased if you have an open mind. And so which side are we on? This is not a religious issue, folks. I don't care what religion you are. I don't care if you believe in God. I don't care about anything on that. Yeah, I served a mission, but that's a side point. Okay. My point is this is a moral issue, okay? This is morality. Are you on the side of liberty, on the side of freedom, on the side of the original intent of the Constitution, Bill of Rights? Are you on the side of good, truth, right, on the side of God? Or on the side of, a creator? Or are you on the side of death, authoritarianism, enslavement, apathy, tyranny, lies, fraud, deceit, Lucifer? You may not even realize that you're already making the choice by not even making a choice. You may say, I don't want to get involved. Ezra Taft Benson gave a great talk on that when he said, there's a lot of people who say, well, I don't want to get involved in the cause for freedom. It's too scary. It's too uncomfortable. It's too unpopular. But then what did he say? Do you remember? Anybody? He says those people who can't make up their mind get end up hitting by traffic going both ways because they can't figure out what side they're on. So by not making a choice of the former over the latter, you are by default taking a stand. By not finding out the truth and that you are being manipulated, you're being led like a bovine to the slaughter. The only issue is there's a few of us around, and it's growing day by day. There's a bunch of you here. Maybe you're all there. If you're all bulls in the pen, slamming against the gates, saying, "Hey, something's going on. We don't want to go down this chute. Don't go down the chute. You're going to get slaughtered. If you're doing that, then I congratulate you." But that's what we're trying to do tonight too. And so here's three questions for you, and then we've got a little video presentation. Okay. So I'm going to try to stay. John, I appreciate John and Gordon for putting together this PowerPoint for us tonight. So we're going to have two objectives. We're going to present evidence for your discernment regarding 9/11, and then two, discuss the larger plan. Here's three questions, though, first. How many, don't be afraid to raise your hands, okay? You're among friends. No one's going to bite you or scratch you or anything. How many of you still believe the official Warren Commission report on the JFK assassination? You might say, well, what's that got to do with 9/11? Just bear with me for a minute, okay? Just go with me on this. I don't see too many hands. We got one hand over here. Thank you, sir, for being honest. We love you. Appreciate you. Number two, how many of you still believe the official story from Bush, Rice, Powell, Cheney, etc., of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Sir, you're okay on that one? Okay. Good. Well, we still love you. Number three, how many of you still believe the official story about Bashar al-Assad, gassing his own people in order to provoke an attack from the United States? That was a recent one. That was that last week. Come on, there's got to be somebody in here that's buying that load of... I'm sorry. Come on. Raise your hand. Come on. You're among friends, remember? All right. Well, John Kerry, bless his plastic face, was totally slamming... calling the congressman and everybody else that would listen, that we're responsible. If there's any more gas attacks, or if there's any more thing like that, any more attacks at all, that we who are opposed to it are responsible for that. How you like that? Well, the funny thing is, him and Pelosi and Harry Reid and John McCain, it's an equal opportunity treasonal fest there. They are all saying, well, you know what? 189 countries signed the anti-chemical weapons document back in 1925, and Assad is an evil, evil man for doing this. And of course, they don't have any proof that he actually did it. And the proof is all coming out, according to WorldNet Daily and other sources, that it was the rebels, the Al Qaeda rebels, that actually did it. How about that? And who's running the rebels? The CIA. We're funding it. That's right. We're training troops who are training them. So. I mean, our guys are training them. It's really upside down. It's hard to comprehend. But anyway, I don't want to get off on that too much. But John Kerry says, and Pelosi yesterday said, this is just an outrage. We the civilized world cannot accept this kind of action. We can't, chemicals have been illegal for, 100 years or 80 years or whatever it's been. Well, they conveniently forget to tell you that, the United States used phosphorus in Iraq, right? Burns your skin right off completely. We're using depleted uranium in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that stuff it was illegal, and it was against the rules for our military to use that prior to 1990, because anybody that even gets close to it gets cancer almost immediately within a very short period of time. And all of our boys and girls are being exposed to that stuff. How about Iraq using chemical weapons against the Kurds and against Iran in the 80s. And guess who gave or sold that to them? We did. Okay? So there's another example of something that happened in the last 80 years that, we don't want to talk about that. Shh, 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 don't talk about that. And then if that wasn't enough of a memory jogger, how about this? 20 million Vietnamese were sprayed with Agent Orange, a very toxic chemical, back in the Vietnam War. And you may say, my dad fought in that war, and we needed to go there. Okay, that's a side issue. The point is, we used chemical weapons there, okay? We did. So, last question. How many of you at this point still believe the official 9/11 Commission report, the official story of 9/11? 3, 4. Thank you. We are so happy that you're here tonight, especially you four. Seriously. I'm not making a joke. I'm not making a joke here. Okay, so we're going to show you a quick, it's about 15-minute video presentation put out by the architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth. Over 2,000 architects and engineers These are not some slack like me, okay, who gets up with a microphone and thinks you know something, because I don't know jack, all right? But these are, you're going to see, highly decorated, highly articulate, highly, you know, all these doctors and of science and engineers and all of these, over 2,000 of them have signed the document calling for further investigations because what the official story is doesn't add up. It violates all the natural laws, all the laws of physics, et cetera, et cetera. It makes no sense. And I can't explain it to you, but this video can. So we're going to roll that now. Go ahead, John.
Throughout the ages, architects and engineers have designed and built the great structures that have made our world and withstood the test of time. Hi, I'm Ed Asner. Welcome to Architects and Engineers. Let's look now at modern steel frame buildings. This is the Empire State Building, a marvel of modern architecture. It was built to last. Architects and engineers of today use computers to design and engineer buildings that will endure the forces of nature, such as earthquakes, fires, and hurricanes. This modern skyscraper was also built to last. We've seen buildings completely destroyed like this before, but only when done intentionally. Danny Jawenko is the expert on this in Europe. What did he say?
Dit is controlled demolition.
Zeker weten.
Zeker weten. Er is nagesprongen. Dit is in opdracht gebeurd. Dit heeft een team gedaan van experts.
Let's compare. Explosives are used to demolish buildings like this in just seconds. Okay, so it's a controlled demolition. What's the problem with that? Well, it happened on the afternoon of 9/11. At the World Trade Center. Let's just think about this. Controlled demolitions cannot be engineered and rigged in a day. It takes months. And therefore, this event must have been planned in advance.
Keep your eye on that building. It's coming down.
Did they actually use the word brought down, and who was it that was telling you this?
In the fire department, and they did use the word, we're going to have to bring it down.
And these people heard explosions.
We heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. It looked like there was a shockwave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out. About a second later, the bottom floor caved out. The building followed after that.
He takes his hand off, and you hear 3, 2, 1, and it was boom, 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 boom.
And these reporters recognized it as a controlled demolition.
And I turned in time to see what looked like a skyscraper implosion. Looked like it had been done by a demolition crew. The whole thing just collapsing down itself.
For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
It was almost as if it were a planned implosion. It just pancaked.
So what's the problem if this was a planned demolition? Well, we are told by government agencies that this building came down as a result of normal office fires. The National Institute of Standards and Technology produced their final report in 2008.
World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives or from fuel oil fires.
But what do you think brought down the building?
And what caught my eye is more than 1,300 architects and engineers examine the evidence about Building 7's collapse and disagree with the official report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I certainly am much more open-minded about it than I was, and it is because of the involvement of the 9/11 families and all these engineers and architects.
You are about to hear from architect of 23 years, Richard Gage, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Now there are more than 1,500 architects and engineers who say that it could not have been brought down by office fires. They are backed by 9/11 family members who are calling for an independent, unbiased investigation.
I'm Richard Gage. Fires have never before caused the collapse of any skyscraper, even though there are numerous examples of much hotter, larger, and longer-lasting fires in these buildings. And in the case of Building 7, the fire that NIST said started the collapse had actually burned out over an hour before. It could not have caused the collapse, as NIST claims. Yet this 47-story modern steel-framed skyscraper, which was not hit by an airplane, collapses mostly into its own footprint like a house of cards, as fast as a bowling ball falling off the side of the building. In just under 7 seconds. Listen to the experts.
Building number 7 descended in free fall for the first 100 feet, which means that there was absolutely no resistance to the descent whatsoever.
NIST has admitted it went into free fall for 8 stories. And going from motionless to free fall instantly, that's a bothersome part of the puzzle because NIST never explained it.
We've got a building that came down in its own footprint, so all of the columns really needed to be severed at the same time in order for that structure to fall the way that we saw.
The symmetry is the smoking gun.
The whole building completely comes down in one continuous motion. There couldn't have been any structural resistance.
According to NIST, the failure occurred at column 79 on level 12. They're talking about a single columnar collapse or failure that resulted in a total collapse of the building.
It is possible that you could have a local failure as a result of a connection failing. But the likelihood of that failure dragging the entire building in such a fashion that all the columns would fail at the same time is an impossibility.
Impossibility?
Yes.
What I saw, it was a classic implosion. The center of the core, the penthouse area, starts to move first, and then the building follows along with it.
I'd like to know why NIST excluded the document from FEMA in Appendix C that documented the evidence of melting steel. Why is this forensic evidence not being included in the report?
In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel. And yet we have evidence of molten iron. R.J. Lee Company, USGS, and Dr. Stephen Jones's work, all three separately found these microspheres.
In the dust, we found what we characterize as unreacted thermitic material in the shape of some very tiny red-gray chips, which have different properties, and in the reaction they produce molten iron, which is the prime indication of a thermitic reaction. And such a reaction can be used to destroy steel structures. What we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite.
There were these iron microspheres present in all of the dust samples that needed to have been formed in extremely high temperatures.
I've independently seen thermitic activity within 2 separate independent samples of World Trade Center dust. My contention, based on finding thermite residue in the dust, is that it happened before. It didn't happen after in the fires that ensued in the rubble pile afterwards. All the characteristics of the microspheres tell me that thermite was involved in melting those steel beams.
So thermite, if it was present at the World Trade Center and created this molten metal that so many witnesses and photographic evidence shows, would also explain the fact that the fires could not be put out at Ground Zero.
The only thing that is consistent with all of the evidence that we have that could cause such a thing is the use of thermite to cut through the steel.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel. Molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Yeah. Like lava.
Like
a volcano.
Well, the manual gets into thermite, and if it says if you have melted steel or concrete, which we had on 9/11, we should test for it.
It's this fused element of steel, molten steel and concrete and all of these things all fused by the heat into one single element.
We're asking for an investigation that follows national standards. There's no excuse to not test for this. If terrorists use explosives in 93, why didn't we test for them? If all these witnesses heard explosions, why aren't we testing for them?
NIST concedes that they found no evidence for explosives. So then we asked them, well, did you look? And they said, no, we did not look for explosives or residues of explosives.
So the preconceived notion of NIST is that there's no evidence for explosives, and so there's no point in looking. That is the most unscientific thing that you can possibly think of, not to look because you don't expect to find evidence, and in fact the evidence is overwhelming. They state these conclusions for which there's virtually no evidence, and then they ignore conclusions that can be drawn from the evidence.
The Freedom of Information Act request to NIST was denied with the claim that releasing this data might jeopardize public safety. How could it possibly jeopardize public safety?
The destruction of evidence was a criminal act in itself. It was already being carted away and destroyed when the FEMA investigators got there about a month after September 11th.
You can't do science when you are deprived of the evidence and when your hypothesis is the least valid instead of the most likely. And the most likely hypothesis in the case of Building 7 wasn't even mentioned. This is not science.
The scientific forensic evidence, ignored by NIST, but carefully reviewed by teams of technical professionals, corroborates the hypothesis of explosive control demolition. We traveled to 21 foreign countries and 32 American cities bringing this evidence to the attention of the public. And we're backed by 9/11 family members and other concerned citizens who are calling for an independent, unbiased investigation.
I'm a family member trying to find out the answers to the murder of 3,000 plus people. The bottom line is that it needs to be investigated properly.
Please look at architects and engineers. People all around the world, scientists all around the world, are questioning this. And there's some deep, deep explaining to do.
It took some kind of consciousness raising on my part before I was willing to look at the possibilities. And really, you need to go where the evidence leads.
As an engineer, I have 3 degrees in engineering. I signed that petition for architects and engineers for 9/11 truth some time ago because the American people absolutely need the truth of 9/11.
Look at the evidence. In fact, I'll say this very categorically. Any reasonable person who looks at the evidence that's been brought forward has got to come away with the feeling that something has to be done, a real investigation has to be put forward.
We will never heal. This country will never, ever, ever forget that day. We have to demand a new investigation. I want justice here.
The country owned this. We were all victims. You all should want answers. It's not just ours, not just mine. We all lost something that day.
It's distressing for everyone to come to terms with this evidence. But we must pursue the truth wherever it leads. Look at the evidence and decide for yourself.
Thank you, John. So, a lot of information in there, and I hope that with all those scientific terms, your eyes don't just glaze over like mine might have done the first time and say, oh, it's so much information, I can't handle it, I can't deal with it. Next week is the 12th anniversary? Yes. 12th anniversary of one of the most horrific things to ever happen in the United States. And so now I want to go through a few slides to kind of recap what we just seen, and I want to stay focused on these few points. So we're going to ignore the hundreds of theories about what happened. The truth can be boiled down to three key points. And each of us should become an expert in these three points because it's very basic. If we stay focused on this, then we don't get off into myriads of theories and argumentative things. These are three things that are proven. You saw a lot of the proof just now. And you can go home and research this and get more proof. Next. Okay, so NIST has admitted free fall speed, but now they're in a quandary because free fall speed means only one thing. That means controlled demolition. It's impossible for a building to fall like this pair of glasses onto the table without any resistance. Okay, and you say, well, wait a minute, what do you mean resistance? Well, if the official conspiracy theory were valid, okay, and they use the pancake effect, remember that thing where slam, slam, okay? I'm no expert, but I do know one thing, that if one story is coming down and hits another story, before it can make it go down, there's some resistance that is going to take a little bit of time. Are you with me on that? That little bit of time and resistance and inertia and stuff is all inexplainable with the official conspiracy theory. Now, let me put it to you in a different way. Let's say you're going in a car going 900 miles an hour, and there's three semis lined up at a stoplight, and you slam your car into the back of the first semi, okay? What's going to happen? You're going to hit resistance, right? Are you going to blow through all three of those semis and keep going through the intersection at 900 miles an hour? Let's say you got through all three semis. Even still, you know, if you were lucky, you'd be going through at much slower speed. Does that make sense? So the Building 7 came down in 7.5 seconds, whatever it was. That means that it fell like a bowling ball, like they said, without any resistance, 47 stories. Impossible. And even if the pancake theory were valid, which it's not, but if it was, and even if it only hit 1 second, boom, 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 that would have caused the whole collapse to go 2 minutes, 1 minute? Well, 47 seconds, I guess you could say, at 1 second per floor. Call it a minute, whatever. See, can you see 7 seconds versus 47 seconds? It might not sound like a lot, but believe me, it is. Okay, so do we think we covered that? And it can only be done with explosives.
The final version of the NIST WTC-7 report just came out. And guess what? We have a revised analysis of the building collapse rate. Constant speed is out. Constant acceleration is out. Instead, we have three phases of collapse with a whopping 2.25 seconds of absolute free fall. The irrelevant 5.4 seconds is still defended in the wording, but it plays no apparent role other than CYA for John Gross and Associates. So free fall is hereby official dogma. How are they going to handle all the ramifications of that inconvenient fact? Read on. It says, the three stages of collapse progression described above are consistent with the results of the global collapse analysis discussed in Chapter 12 of NIST's NC-STAR 1-9. That's it. Freefall went from an impossibility that required backflips and logic to obfuscate to a simple fact that you measured then declared consistent with their fire-induced collapse hypothesis. Apparently, they have now decided that freefall is okay as long as it is seen as a part of a longer stretch of time that covers the required 5.4 seconds. In other words, they dropped the bullying tactic of blowing smoke to obscure the facts and adopted an alternate bullying tactic, cover it with a lie and walk away. However, NIST cannot walk away from freefall. Now that NIST has certified freefall as fact, take a look at the implications.
Okay, so there you have it. NIST for years fought against the evidence that there was free fall speech. They said, oh, no, no, it was a pancake thing, blah, blah. Well, what was it, 2011, I believe, they finally agreed that there was, okay, there was some free fall. We're not going to admit all of it, but we're going to admit part of it, which you saw there. And that opens it up that if there was any free fall, it could not be anything but controlled demolition. Okay, next point. Okay, fact. The carbon fuels and office equipment and papers and chairs and desks and all that kind of stuff cannot melt steel. Have you ever gone up, anybody ever gone up the canyon and had a barbecue or have a barbecue in your backyard or in your, on your porch? And you turn that puppy on, you're grilling your meat, and how many times do you have to go out the next day and buy another barbecue because your barbecue melted? Well, hang on a second. You know, that's what they're telling us happened. But the difference is that barbecue is going for 10, 20, 30 minutes at a constant deal. When the fuel exploded on those the planes, when they hit the buildings, and by the way, no building hit, no plane hit Building 7. You remember that, right? They hit Building 1 and 2, no plane hit this building. But how many, it's impossible. You could take a whole truckload of kerosene, jet fuel, kerosene, carbon-based fuel, take it and dump it on the barbecue grill up the canyon. Now, the forest ranger might get mad at you about that, but if you did that, you still would not melt that barbecue grill. Because while you would have a high degree of temperature, it would only be poof. I mean, how many of you have been foolish enough to... How many Boy Scouts do we have in here? Have you ever done this where you pour a little gasoline on it on a fire that's already going, maybe? Or if it's not, if you're smarter than me and you wait until you put the gasoline on and then... Remember that? And it goes, boom, you know, and maybe you singe your eyebrows or knuckle, the hair on your knuckles. But it's only for a second. It only hurts for a second, right? It's impossible. Okay, so that's what happened with the jet fuel, the kerosene. It boom like that. And then after that, it was all residual office equipment fire. There was no fuel burning for hours on end. It's impossible. It didn't happen.
Even if it was fuel, what is that stuff in your propane stove?
F-U-E-L?
F-U-E-L, okay.
Okay, next slide. So anyway, you can all research this on your own. I think steel melts or begins to get soft at 2,700 degrees, if I'm not mistaken. Carbon fuels can never get hotter than 1,100 degrees, 1,600 degree difference. And that's if you had, you know, the fire on there for a while. I mean, like a blowtorch. Now, if you add other incendiary things, like what do they use in welding? Acetylene, oxygen. Add some other things like that, then, yeah, you can melt it. But that's not the case here. Okay, another video. You'll like this. Watch this guy's body language. Watch his body language.
A pool of molten steel was found in the bottom of the tower.
Tell me about it. Have you seen it?
Well, not personally, but my witnesses there found huge pools of molten steel beneath the towers. And some scientists don't think that the collapse of the building could have melted all that steel. And physics professor analyzed some of the steel. And Stephen Jones, he found evidence of thermite residue, which would explain how the buildings collapsed by means of pre-planted explosives. So have you analyzed the steel for one of those residues?
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, there's no eyewitness who said so.
You get down below and you see molten steel. Molten steel running down the channel roads. Like you're in a foundry.
The fires got very intense down there and actually melted beams where it was molten steel that was being dug out.
This fused element of steel, molten steel, and concrete, and all of these things all fused by the heat into one single element.
And almost like a chunk of lava from Kilauea or Iceland, where they're very sharp, but break.
Okay, so before we go into that one real quick, so molten metal at the bottom indicates much higher temperatures than 1,100 degrees, okay? Much higher temperatures than carbon-based fuels can provide. So, that being said, the third section that we want to talk about is unexploded incendiary molecules, if you will, found in the dust samples collected immediately after the buildings came down that were tested by four independent laboratories and confirmed unexploded red-gray thermite chips and iron spheres in the dust. So you heard him talking about iron being generated. Well, iron spheres, like that molten lava ball you saw, can't happen unless of those temperatures that are that hot and created by something other than just a carbon-based fire. So you saw earlier that Stephen Jones, well, you know what? Actually, it's in the next video clip, right? So I'll just let him explain it since he's not here. He can explain it for himself right there. Go ahead.
I was examining a dust sample, which I'd obtained from Jeanette McKinley. I was using a loop and also just looking at it with my eyes and an ordinary optical microscope, although stereo, so that I could see better in three dimensions. And what I found was a chip that looked like it might be a paint chip. I mean, early on, I was thinking, maybe not too interesting. But this chip was rather striking in its appearance. It had an orange-red color, first of all. And then I found several of these, and they all had some gray material adhering to the side of the red material. So layered. Later we found multiple layers, but most of these chips had two layers, red, gray. I did take one of these chips then to the electron microscope, the scanning electron microscope, and we looked at it with the electron microscope, and then we used a system where we could determine the elements. What we found in the red material is a combination of aluminum and iron oxide, and these are the components of thermite. Of course, now we looked with an electron microscope, we looked deeper and deeper, higher and higher magnification. And I pulled in a colleague of mine, Dr. Jeffrey Ferrer. He's an expert on the electron microscope machine. So he actually broke a piece off of one of these red chips, and then later he did four different samples, broke a piece off. That gives you a fresh surface. Because in the dust, there's all sorts of stuff. There's zinc and titanium and calcium, all sorts of stuff. So he broke off a tip, you see, so we can look at a fresh surface. And then what you see in all four samples that we studied in this detail, carbon, which is significant, oxygen, iron, and aluminum. We looked at this, and these, again, are the ingredients, except for the carbon. And we found that experimenters working with super thermite, trying to beef it up, make it more explosive, tailoring it to different weapons applications, they would have silicon in there and an organic material, which means carbon, so a polymer such as Viton, they would add to this to give it the properties they wanted. So that fit. Now, see, that was surprising to me to see silicon and carbon, but then we find in the literature that's what these guys are doing in the weapons labs, Livermore and Los Alamos. They're adding organic because that gives you a gas production. When the thermite goes off, now you also have gas production, which gives you the explosive force, for instance. I suggested that we take a sample of this red-gray chip material and run it through a very sensitive instrument called a differential scanning calorimeter. And he did that. What it does, you heat the temperature slowly, and the material will react if it's going to. And if it reacts and produces heat, you'll get a spike in your calorimeter. And then if it reacts quickly, it'll be a narrow spike. If it, say, burns over a long period of time, you'll see a big, broad spike. And the total area there is the total amount of energy released. And it gives you a lot of information. What we found, what Dr. Ferrer found first, and he was real excited when he told me about this, he took one of these chips and he put it in the differential scanning calorimeter, and sure enough, it went off at right about 430 centigrade, but more importantly, the peak was high, which means a lot of energy released, and narrow, which means, in his terms, it blew up. You know, you say, man, this is it, this stuff blows up. It behaves just like nano. It has the ingredients of nanothermite. He said, well, there should be, in a thermite reaction, you should produce molten iron. So you should see some spheres of iron. Think of a spraying water in the air, you get droplets that are more or less spherical because the surface tension pulls the liquid into the sphere. It's very simple. Same thing with molten iron from the thermitic reaction, whether it's ordinary conventional thermite or the super nanothermite. Either way, you get this molten iron, and you should get these droplets of iron. So we said, we got to look for those, you know. If you don't find those, maybe, who knows what it is, but we got to find droplets of molten iron, otherwise we're not sure we have the thermite reaction, the thermitic reaction. In this case, it's a nanothermite. So we looked, and wow, what a beautiful sight. As you look at this, after the red materials reacted, there are these little spheres, just tons of them. We compared the traces that we got in this sophisticated calorimeter with traces obtained with known thermite. These are published data, and our peak is actually narrower. I mean, this stuff goes off with very rapidly, and with and more energy also than.
Okay, it continues to go on from there, but enough of that. So, okay, now you have some important facts. We've covered three significant points of fact just now. So you have to decide. And when you're discussing this with others, stay on the facts. Don't get off onto alien particle weapons or space beams or chupacabras or whatever, or alien Pacific Rim, you know, what is that? The old Japanese movies, what were they?
Godzilla.
Godzilla's coming, you know, doing stuff. No. Is the next slide on? Okay. The question we want to go to now in just a second is, do you see a larger plan at play here? You can attribute this to coincidence. You can attribute this to, oh, it just, well, some, you know, it's really weird that happened. I can't imagine how it happened. Or you can deal with reality and say, if Building 7 was brought down by controlled demolition, and they lied to us and said it wasn't, because that's how the story was at first, just fires. In fact, they're sticking to that story. What else are they lying to us about? Everything? Maybe. Or maybe they're only lying at 98%. I don't know. But the point is that if... And if this is your first time seeing this, you're probably thinking, oh my gosh, and so we'll get you out of here pretty quick in just a few minutes. And we'll have a part two for the hardcore after that. So the question is why? There's a Latin term called cui bono. You know what that means, right? Who benefits? Cui bono. That's like follow the money, that kind of thing. Well, when you're dealing with secret combinations at the highest level of the world, it's not really about the money anymore because they print the money. Okay, it's about power and control. And so, anyway, my part, I'm about done here, but I wanted to kind of give you the David Letterman top 10 anomalies, and I don't even like David Letterman, but someone suggested I do that that spiel. The top 10 anomalies, in my opinion, of 9/11, outside of these three facts. So remember, don't remember anything else you hear tonight from me or the panel, just these three facts, okay? Just the three facts we covered. What were they again, ladies and gentlemen? Free fall speed, molten metal, molten steel, and nanothermite residue. Those three things. You can hang your red baseball cap on that one, sir, on all three of those. Now, these other 9 or 10, I can't quite hang my hat on exactly, but you're going to say, really? Whoa. And then our panel, when I turn over to them in a minute, are probably going to give you a bunch of others, and I don't know where this is going to go because it's not pre-scripted. But, by the way, if you haven't filled out a question yet into the jug, please do that. And you got a few in the back? Okay, he's got the jar back there. Put your questions in there, and feel free to get up during the time. We won't think you're rude. We'll just think, you know, you're going to the bathroom or something. And put your question in there, and then Brian can run them up to us. Okay, not in any particular order, number 10. Alleged terrorist passport was found on top of the dust pile by an FBI agent within six hours of the attack. Now you remember those buildings coming down, concrete, tons and tons of stuff, steel and concrete, pulverized, fire, smoke, hell on earth. And yet, within 6 hours, in fact, it was less than that, but I don't remember the exact time, They found an intact paper passport from one of the alleged terrorists. Now, how convenient is that? You know? Okay. Number nine. There was a tenfold increase, actually, it was up more than tenfold. It was up a 12-fold increase on put options on American Airlines and United Airlines for the day of the attack. Huh. So every day, let's say every day is 100%, right? Normal day of put options. People betting, stocks go down, for those of you who don't know. Putting, as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong if there's any brokers in the house, but you're betting that the stock's going to go down. And there was a 10 to 12-fold increase, depending on what you read, on put options for that day for those airlines. Hmm. Well, I guess if I was involved in that, I'd probably do that too. You know, make some easy money like Hillary Clinton did. Okay, number eight. Are you aware that there was a BBC reporter who was on TV at 4:30 in the afternoon who said, and they handed her a paper, and she said, oh, this just in? The Solomon Brothers building, and this is a BBC reporter, my English accent's not very good, but the Solomon Brothers building has just collapsed in its footprint. And she looks at the screen, and the building's there in the back, smoking a little bit, and it's still standing. Okay? YouTube it. You'll find it. It's there. So 5:22. Okay, so I'm off by half an hour. Thank you, Brandon. Thanks for that technical correction.
And to put off the things you're talking about, a normal day of trading is right around 500 to 600. That day, there was over 12,000.
Oh, so I was underestimating that.
Over 12,000 put options on United Airlines and American Airlines.
Okay. Yeah, so that's okay. So, Brandon, why don't you come up here and be on the panel? I'm just kidding. Okay, number seven. Number seven. Okay, another BBC report that, and if I'm not mistaken, Brandon, if I'm off by one, let me know. Seven of the 19 alleged hijackers were reported to still be alive months after the report. In fact, there was one of the hijackers who was in Pakistan who saw his picture on the screen and said, you know, what the heck? His picture and his name as one of the hijackers. And he was in Pakistan, nowhere near it. Number seven, you already heard about this. All the rubble was destroyed and hauled off to China to be processed before any investigation could be allowed to be finished. In fact, before they could even get started. And in a crime scene, you don't do that. There's all kinds of reports from different crime investigators who say, that should have never happened. That's a big anomaly. Number six, are you aware that $2.3 trillion was reported missing by Donald Rumsfeld from the Pentagon budget on September 10th. Okay? He makes that announcement on the news the night of September 10th. Well, normally investigators, reporters, and things would follow that up, right? But the next morning, something happened, and that went away like all the other scandals. But more important than that, those records of that $2.3 trillion loss were just conveniently stored in the office where the plane hit the Pentagon. All those records were destroyed. Sorry about that. End of story. Number five. We're not going to go into that, but yeah, okay. Number five, let's see here. I already said that one. Okay, sorry. Number four. How many of you are familiar with the story of Dick Cheney in the bunker under the in Washington, D.C., with Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation? There's a YouTube clip. Go home and see it. Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation, when he's testifying to Congress about what happened. And he said, quote, well, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close to the quote. He said, a staffer came in and said to Vice President Cheney, sir, the plane is 50 miles out. Do the orders still stand? Yes, they do. Then he said, the staffer came back a minute later and said, sir, the plane is 30 miles out. Do the orders still stand? Yes. He came back in and said, sir, the plane is 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And Mineta says, he jerked his head around, whipped his head around, and screamed at the staffer, yes, have you heard anything to the contrary? Okay, that was the plane that was coming into the Pentagon. Okay. Yeah, they don't touch a lot of these things that we're talking about here aren't in the 9/11 Commission report. Isn't that convenient? This kind of reminds me of the Warren Commission, like, you know, and all, from 61 and all that stuff that they omitted. Okay, number three. Are you aware that some of the terrorists, the alleged terrorists, were actually trained at U.S. military bases? Colonel Ken McClellan at the International Officer School, if I'm not mistaken, that's in the San Francisco? Or in Florida, I can't remember. Montgomery, okay. Anyway, they were trained at different places, but this guy testified from this one that, did he mention the name in the clip that we saw earlier? Joe?
No.
Okay, but he said that, hey, we had one of those guys that was training with our people. And so you kind of say, really? And there's also other stories about from the embassy, the consulate agent in... I forgot. Anyway, you can research all this yourself. But anyway, there's a lot of anomalies. There's a ton of anomalies, a ton of things that make you go, Did you know that NORAD stood down? Okay, the year prior to 9/11, scramblers, jet fighters were scrambled 67 times when jet airliners, commercial airliners, went off course by a slight degree. 67 times in 2000. All right? On September 11th, no fighters were scrambled for an hour and 45 minutes. And those things can go very, very fast. If they would have been scrambled within a few minutes like they normally are, none of this would have ever happened. So you can think what you want, but I'm pretty convinced in my own finite little brain, you know, from the educated in the public school system, that it'd be virtually impossible, if everything else was true, it'd be virtually impossible for a guy in a turban in a cave 7,000 miles away with a little Apple laptop to get NORAD to stand down, North American Air Defense, to stand down for an hour and a half. Are you with me on that one? Can I get an amen, brothers and sisters? And then number one, this is, have you heard of the PNAC document? The Project for the New American Century. Okay, this is a document that was sent to President Clinton back in 98, if I'm not mistaken. And it said, you know what, we've got to rebuild America's military, and there's only one way to do it. And the section that you may be familiar with is Section 5, called Of Rebuilding American Defenses, Creating Tomorrow's Dominant Force, and includes the sentence, quote, "Further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor." Okay, all right, we have a quick 2 minute, do we have the Wesley Clark thing? Okay, so we're gonna turn the time over to our expert panel, but first I wanna show you a 2 minute clip from, to help you understand a little bit the bigger picture and why we've gotten involved in so many wars in the last few years. This is from General Wesley Clark, and I think you'll get a kick out of this.
10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs, just said hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you gotta come in. You gotta come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?"
This is 2001.
He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're gonna take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
Is there a plan in place?
The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region.
Okay. This is a headline from today? Yeah, okay. So I'm sure all of you have called your congressmen and congresswomen and senators and said, hey, let's go bomb those SOBs, yeah. Let's go bomb the brown man. Let's go turn it into a parking lot. Well, maybe not, because apparently they were going 500-1 against going. So if you're like me, then you called against it. I'd like to turn the time over now to our expert panel. Well, they may not exactly be experts any more than I am, but they are good guys. And they're very smart. They're a lot smarter than I am, I can tell you that much. First, we have Dan Campbell, a business owner and researcher. We have Dr. Jack Monette, author. And by the way, he's got some books back there. And I highly recommend The Red Book, especially, is my favorite. If you haven't gotten it, I think there's two or three left back there. Coming to us from Mount Pleasant, we have Joe Williamson, a good friend, former nuclear weapons officer, who's really intelligent on this kind of stuff. And we have Dale Williams, talk show host and researcher. And so, gentlemen, I'm going to turn the time over to you. You guys can have some opening remarks, and I'm going to go get the questions, if there's any back there, and then we'll come back on that in a few minutes. Okay? Who wants to go first? Opening remarks. Yeah, go for it, gentlemen.
As Tom was going through some of the facts on 9/11, I wrote down how versus why, and he kind of got to that. And I think the why of this whole thing is really important.
Could you stand up?
Sure. There was one of the guys in the AE 9/11 Truth video who's a mathematician. He said, I had to sort of have a raise in my consciousness. I had to allow myself to believe what I didn't want to believe. That's what he was saying there, is that there was a point where he had to look at some of these facts with an open mind, whereas previously it was closed. And I have a good friend, Abe Day. I don't know if he's here. But I had been defending the mainstream side of things. I was upset with what Congress was doing, but, you know, back in 2007 or 2008-ish, I can't remember, defending what they were doing. I'd read a lot on the subject, and I just remember him dropping, like Tom did. He's like, Dan, you don't get it. He starts dropping this thing at a party, and he's like, that's why 9/11 was an inside job, and he just repeatedly did it. He's like, that's why it's an inside job. And I spent about a year reading about it, and finally, after watching a video, I allowed myself to believe that we'd been deceived. And I realized that I don't apologize for this, but I'm going to make some reference to the Book of Mormon. So if you're not LDS, find somebody that is and tell them to read the Book of Mormon. And I mean not just read it. Read it and believe what it says. I realized that we were not, as a nation, behaving like Moroni, Captain Moroni, and the Nephites who were defending at the time of the war chapters. Defending. We were actually like the Lamanites who had been deceived into going to war under Amalickiah. And I realized I was living in enemy territory. And then I learned through experience that it's very difficult to discuss this with family and friends and anybody who is not open-minded to the idea that most people could be deceived and that the world at large may actually be living in the Matrix, so to speak. So it's been a really interesting awakening for me the last 5-6 years. But the why is really important. And the reason that we have wars is found scripturally in the book of Moses in chapter 6. You feel free to open your scriptures and turn with me to Moses chapter 6. Oh, it wants me to update. I'm going to do that. I'll do that later. I guess I could do that right now. Moses chapter 6, verse 15, "And the children of men were numerous upon the face of the land. And in those days Satan had great dominion among men and raged in their hearts. And from thenceforth came wars and bloodshed. And a man's hand was against his own brother in administering death because of secret works seeking for power." That is why we have war, because of secret works seeking for power. That's Moses chapter 6, verse 15. Now, I don't have to prove anything to you by the scriptures. I've been writing a bunch of stuff, and I might get a chance here in a future event to give you some of the logical reasons and maybe talk a little bit about this, but I'm almost done with sourcing people, okay? I don't feel like we need to make an appeal to credibility anymore. It's too late for that. You need to appeal to God, the Holy Spirit, and reason, because it's becoming so obvious. Just like my friend would drop this, it's becoming that obvious, and the world at large is that deceived. Traditionally, honorable men have followed rules before getting into a war. If you have your concealed carry permit, my guess is 45 to 65% of you guys in here have one. You learn the rules of morality that we all agree on that you have to follow if you're going to take another man's life. And I found it interesting that those same rules have been applied to nations, to kingdoms and countries in the civilized era. When we lived under kings, there was no Congress. There was no declaration of war. The king did whatever the king wanted, so long as his bankers approved of it. And, before the bankers, they do whatever they want. They kill whoever they want, off with his head, or let's go to war over here on a whim. But after the Magna Carta and under English common law, and as we became more enlightened, we began to follow this morality. The same morality applies to individuals when you're carrying concealed, and it applies to nations, and that is that you must have an imminent threat. You must have an imminent and immediate and certain threat. God is not expecting you to absorb the first strike. In fact, if you read the war chapters, you'll see that Moroni and Pahoran discussed that. We wouldn't go to war if God said don't go to war. And if he wanted us to lay down our lives, we would. But he didn't. He said we could defend ourselves. And the issue of imminent threat was changed in 2001. When you're going to take a life, if you're carrying concealed, the things you need to consider is that you can't start the fight, number one. You must be in fear for your own life or the life of someone else, or they're going to be harmed irreparably. They're going to be maimed. And then you have to have this imminent threat. And an imminent threat consists of three different things: opportunity, ability, and jeopardy. I've got a knife here. I don't think Jack is afraid of me, but I've got a weapon here. I have the opportunity and the ability, but he may be carrying concealed and he hasn't yet shot me. Okay? They teach, my brother's a cop, they teach you that if a man's got a knife and he's 21 feet away, you're justified in killing him if you believe you're in danger. Okay? 21 feet away is what the police follow. Seven steps. Ability and opportunity and jeopardy are required. They must all be satisfied simultaneously. Otherwise, the court is not going to believe that you reasonably thought you were in danger. Nations have to follow the same logic. And this is the why. Okay, this is all getting to the why. The nations have to follow the same rationale, except that because of 9/11, Bush was able to put out the national security strategy and say, hey, we're done with the age-old rationale on morality for war. We're going to base our rationale on the abilities and objectives, or the capabilities and the objectives. That's what they said. We have to adapt our concept of imminent threat to the abilities or capabilities and the objectives of our enemy. They completely remove jeopardy. And we have to trust them. Take an inventory of yourself right now. Tell me what percentage of the media do you actually trust? And what level percentage of the government do you actually trust? So a nuclear bomb could go off tomorrow in Salt Lake City, and you'd have to believe where it came from. You'd have to believe that group of people that you distrust that much. I mean, a man, it's on the Drudge Report today. There's a man in Florida who says he's been thrown in jail because he killed some neighbors at a barbecue, and he's invoked the Bush Doctrine. He said, I'm using the Bush Doctrine, that is that I had to kill them before they killed me for no good reason, to save my own life or whatever. It's absurd, you know. He's going to go to jail for a long time. But we're held unaccountable. We have blood on our hands for a lot of reasons. The why is found in Moses chapter 6. Men seeking for power, secret works in darkness. This is all about control. It's all about money. It's all about global governance, dominance, whatever you want to call it. But that's what's happening. We've abandoned our morality, and now we have TSA. Now we have the NSA. Now we have all of these things. The Orwellian state is descending upon us because we did that, and we didn't hold our ground. And the day after 9/11, regardless of whether you believe it was a terrorist attack, regardless of whether you believe it was a controlled demolition, or whatever brought those buildings down, the fact remains that the day after 9/11, there was no imminent threat. Afghanistan posed no imminent threat. Iraq posed no imminent threat. Nobody was out to get us. We wanted revenge. And the Lord says, vengeance is mine.
I appreciate Dan's remarks very much. By the way, concealed carry, if any of you want to move to Spring City, maybe you're aware that about 6 months ago we passed an ordinance there that said every household should have a gun. And should know how to use it. And the city has taken the responsibility then of training also. So we recommend that to other towns and cities also. The first time I met Dan was in Spring City. It was kind of interesting. We were, what was that, a 24th of July parade?
Yeah.
Something like that.
You mentioned before, but because you came up and spoke, but that was the first time we were there.
Right. And it was kind of interesting. He had some wristbands for sale.
Paracord bracelets.
And the sign above it said, what was it, $2.50 each or a dime? And of course, the dime was the silver dime. And so I gave him a silver dime for some. And it kind of made me think, you know, what has really happened to our country? If you go back and think of some things like that, the 30-cent gasoline, you think of the taking a dime, the nickel candy bars. You know, those things are kind of dead issues, and we have allowed some things to happen that have really hurt us. Now, with all that, let me just mention a few things on what we're talking about here. Stephen Jones spoke for quite a while on different things relating to 9/11, relating to some of the research he's been doing. His paper on NIST, and let me just give a plug on this, because some of you might be interested in reading it. It's in the appendix in this book here, and the paper is quite interesting. It's 14 points where he asks NIST, the society, to actually investigate 9/11. He asks 14 things, and they're unable to answer them. And he's very specific about what needs to be answered and where they fall down. and not being able to do so. What we're talking about, it was referred to as the New Pearl Harbor, and I think most of us understand that phrase, New Pearl Harbor, having to do with false flags. Everybody know what a false flag is? Everybody? Are there those here who don't? Okay, let me mention a false flag then would be something where a country or an individual might perpetrate something and have it blamed on someone else. For example, this 9/11, the towers falling down, we're able to blame that on terrorists. What's so bad about that? Well, you and I have become terrorists. That's the problem, isn't it? And we find that different things have been blamed on others or allowed the media to actually blame others. This began, you know, really began a long way back, but as far as our country is concerned, the first real war that we were entered into that was a false flag was the Spanish-American War. And if you go back and look at the history of that, the Pulitzers with the newspapers, the Hearsts, trying to push the issue there because it sold newspapers, and also it got the bankers involved in sugar, it got them involved in doing things abroad and expanding their influence throughout the world. You go into World War I, another false flag. Why was it a false flag? Well, several things there happened, but the Lusitania. You and I probably learned in school that was a terrible thing that happened. If you look into the Lusitania, what it was J.P. Morgan's ship, and it was a registered warship. It had no business being in the waters where it was, and consequently, when it was sabotaged and shot by a German U-boat, when that happened, we said, oh my word, look, they've attacked us. No, they hadn't attacked us at all. That was, again, a registered warship. You might want to look at the history of World War I, a false flag that began it. What's the benefit in a false flag? It got the people behind it. Those dirty Germans, they've done it to us, we're going to get them back. World War II, another tremendous false flag with the Day of Infamy. And some of you are aware of Pearl Harbor and some of the things that did happen. That's why they call it the New Pearl Harbor here. Because the old Pearl Harbor that happened in 1941 was a false flag. Why? Because we literally, and this book also, again, I'm just going to give another plug because we get into that quite a bit. There's 16 points there showing that Japan was really forced into an attack. We knew it was coming, and yet we decided that instead we would allow them to strike the first blow to get people upset and get riled. And in doing that, we had a nation that got behind the war effort, a war effort that probably was not justified at all. My father, if I could just share an experience with you, my father and my mother had just been married. This was, again, 1941. And in that, they were good Catholics, and so on Sunday, they were down watching a bullfight in Tijuana. And the announcement was made over the loudspeaker there that Japan had just attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor. And my father, and my mother remembers very clearly what he said, I have to fight for my country, the good patriot that he was. And I think many of us know individuals that feel that same way or felt that same way. They felt the same way in Vietnam. They felt that way in many wars because patriotism is warfare, isn't it? We've equated that in our country. And so we can get people excited by putting that demand on patriotism for what it really is not. Well, you go into other things. The Korean War was frankly more the same. Vietnam, Gulf of Tonkin never existed, and yet we gave that as a rationale for it. Look at Kuwait, look at Iraq. So many things that we have since learned were false flags. They really weren't viable to begin with. There's a hand back here. Everybody hear that? Yeah, this is not simply attributed to the United States. It's really a worldwide thing. If you look at the whole history of warfare, remember that statement again, and we've been quoting some LDS scripture here, where Satan dealing with Cain, and Cain leaves that initial meeting between the two, and he said, I have learned the great secret that I can murder and get gain. That's not restricted to the United States by any means. That's a worldwide phenomena. Well, with that, again, just understand these things have been going on for a long time. 9/11 was more of the same, and it became the new Pearl Harbor. There have been several areas, and I'm not going to take too much time because I recognize we're short on time, but I wanted to read something to you that I thought was quite interesting. You know, when Russia, communism, was founded, the Bolshevik Revolution, when that happened, and by the way, that was more of the same, wasn't it? We talked about that as being those dirty, rotten people over there in Russia that wanted to take over the world, when in reality we funded them. We began the whole Russian Empire as we now know it, and we were behind all that. Well, again, we set things up. Why? Because we wanted that straw man for the future. Here is something that Lenin wrote down. I'm going to end on this note, but see how this has taken place. Because what we actually have here, over the course of time, we have been able to look back and see what has transpired. It's difficult to look forward. And we can see certain things fall into place. You and I can't. The neat thing I think about today, I can recall when Steve Jones, Joel Scouse, and I would go around and speak, and we would speak to groups when we get 20 people. Today, when we do that, we get 200 and 300 people. Isn't that interesting? Why? Something's going on, isn't it? People are recognizing things are changing. There's something really happening. We're seeing a movement. Now, as Joel said the other night, we were talking about that, and I was kind of patting ourselves on the back, saying, isn't that neat how people seem to be falling in line? He said, but you know, we're still losing the war. And I said, why? He said, because the public school system is training the youth today. And frankly, when you look at the numbers, we're losing tremendously. Look around you here. We don't have a lot of teenagers here. We don't have a lot of 20-year-olds here. We have older folks. Why? Something in our past has indicated those things ring true. Those who have been brought up in a different time period don't, in many cases, see the same things that you and I do. Anyway, here's what Lenin wrote. He said this was the plan. He said, number one, to confuse, disorganize, and destroy the forces of capitalism around the world. Number two, bring all nations together into a single world system of economy. Number three, force the advanced countries to pour prolonged financial aid into the underdeveloped countries. Is this ringing true? Number four, divide the world into regional groups as a transitional stage to total world government. Populations will more readily abandon their national loyalties to a vague regional loyalty than they will for a world authority. Later, the regionals can be brought all the way into a single world dictatorship of the proletariat. That's word for word what Lenin wrote. We've come a long way, haven't we? And when one looks at that, and one would have to say something is going on. Is it a conspiracy? I love President Benson's words on that. It's not a conspiracy theory, it's a conspiracy fact. Yeah, there's just too much going on. I work with another individual, another Scouse, and he mentioned that every time he says the word conspiracy to a group, he says people look down at their shoes, they look out the window, they look at it. They're embarrassed to hear the word conspiracy. So he changed his verbiage. And now he says things were orchestrated in such a way. And nobody bats an eye. Whatever you want to call it, something is going on. And you and I, fortunately, have been given an inner something that tells us something is not right. And I'm glad to be among you.
I didn't really prepare anything, so I guess as far as when people ask why they would do something like this, has anybody ever heard of Major General Smedley Butler? Okay.
War's a racket.
Yeah, war's a racket. He was, if you could call him something, we would call him the Terminator, because as a colonel, as a full field officer, he was fighting in the trenches in World War I, the Boxer Rebellion, the Opium Wars, things like that. He was the youngest general in Marine history. And all of his commissions were battlefield commissions. So if you ever see pictures of him, he's got a rack that goes from here all the way down to here. He was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor twice. And usually you're dead when you get the Congressional Medal of Honor. And the third time he was up for it, they actually eliminated officers getting it and made it so that it was only enlisted guys. So they gave him, I think it's called the Marine Desiree Award, which there's only been seven of those, I think. Oh, sorry. Anyway, so he wrote a book called War is a Racket, and you can get that online, and I'd highly recommend anybody here read that. It's really short. But he did 33 years. He had all these awards. He was a machine, and he gets out and becomes one of the most vocal anti-war spokespersons in history. I mean, he traveled all around the country. And the one thing he said about war is that it's the most profitable industry that you can imagine. And that's really what it boils down to. I mean, the Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil. And when you look at war, the bankers make a lot of money because they fund both sides. We have the warning from Eisenhower when he left office. He coined the term the military-industrial complex. And he warned, he said, what we've done is we've created a massive industry that all of their profit is based on killing people and breaking things. So when you have that much power, are they going to let peace break out? No. So when peace threatens to break out, they've got to stir it up a little bit. And so it's, you know, boils back to be critical about what you're seeing, be critical about what you're told, do your own thinking. And if you can do that, the world begins to make a lot more sense. Things don't seem so random and strange and filled with incompetent this and stupid that. So anyway, that's my advice. Yes.
I want to say thanks, Reverend Tom, for stealing all 10 of my points. I appreciate that. I'll make it short so we can get to questions and answers. It's nice to see you all here today. You know, the thing I think that's interesting about 9/11 is what it tells us about our fellow Americans. The people in this room aren't the problem. But the people who do polling on 9/11, and Dr. Manette, you can check me if I'm right on this, we've plateaued at about one-third. About one-third of the U.S. population does not believe the government tale about 9/11. Is it raising still? But it's still a minority. Is it close? 255,000-pound object, 124-foot wingspan, it's got 10 or 11,000 gallons of fuel, hits the side of the Pentagon. It doesn't break the windows on either side of a 16-foot hole it makes. I think what we're dealing with is 150, 175 million people who collectively deserve the Darwin Award. And there is a such thing, as a fellow radio host once told me after a very frustrating day of interviewing, there is a such thing as invincible ignorance. And there are a lot of people amongst us who, do you have any street smarts? You've got to ask these people. Look at the building. Look at the Pennsylvania crash site of the other airplane. The county coroner comes out and says, and he's on record as saying this, what am I doing here? There are no bodies. There's no blood. There's no tail of an airplane. There's a 25 by 20, more or less, 10-foot deep hole with light debris scattered around. Nothing else there. You know, after a while, it's like if you're a contractor, you go into a room, you know plumb level square, and you know a building that was not constructed using those techniques. You can tell just by walking in to it. You don't need to have an elaborate presentation, although this is a great primer we've had tonight. So my concern is, what's the end point of all this? back in the 80s when Benjamin Netanyahu was Prime Minister of Israel, he had a white paper produced, and if I recall correctly, it was named Securing the Realm. It may have had a subtitle. Later on, you find this PNAC document that my friends have made a reference to, that the neocon staffers under George Bush Sr., thank you, got to get you up here. Anyway, the PNAC document, the game plan for all of this warfare, it was authored largely by the same people who wrote Benjamin Netanyahu's Securing the Realm. Both of those documents talk about casting the Muslim world into disarray, either regime change or outright warfare, get them into civil war, chaos, whatever it takes. That's what we're seeing here. That's what this is really about. And my concern, and then I'll turn it over to Tom for questions, if you've got half of the American people who don't even want to hear the news, and you've got a government who has disconnected all of the American people from their rights to representative government, which is what we have. None of us have any influence on this. Where do you think that this ship that we're passengers on is going to go? It's going to go to continuing warfare in Western Asia and the Middle East until we run up against the interests of the Russians and Chinese and they stop it, one way or the other. So that's the Darwin Award, Tom, is war, general war. And that means your boys who are 14, 15, 16 years old right now, maybe 17, they're in a lot of trouble if you've got children that age or grandkids. They are in serious jeopardy because general war is not, you know, the province of a volunteer army. General war involves a draft, conscription, nice word. And that's where the fiddler gets paid. So anyway, those are my thoughts, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Okay.
And thanks for inviting Dr. Manette. That red book is the best single volume primer on the subject, if you can get a hold of that red book.
Thank you, Dale. Okay, we've got a few questions from the audience that we'll have the... If you all want to answer or however you guys want to do it, if you have something to add, let's just try to keep it a little bit short so we can get to these questions. If we have any other questions in the back, feel free to give them up. We'll go a few minutes on questions, and then we'll take a break. Okay, question number one. If we assume that it was controlled demolition, which normally takes weeks to prepare for, is there an explanation how that could be done without the building residents seeing it being done? Good question. Dale? Yeah, don't take the mic apart. We're just getting to the good point. Good part.
You know, you've got between the two towers, you've got 270 floors, more or less. And the security apparatus, we know that they had to have charges planted, and yet there's no account of a security guard just once asking, hey, buddy, what are you doing here? Where are you going? What is that you got there? Not one eyewitness report of any irregularity like that. There's an explanation, and it's a big security firm, and the name is too long to even try to remember. The last word in it is Securicom, and that's usually the shorthand name for it. Securicom was run by, the CEO of Securicom was Wirt Walker III. Does that name Walker ring a bell with anybody? George Herbert Walker Bush? He's a first, first or second cousin, I believe a first cousin of GW, of Bush Baby. And Marvin W. Bush, the senior President Bush's brother, major stockholder, board of directors, Securicom. So 6 weeks before Larry Silverstein takes on the 99-year lease for the buildings, including Building 7, and does he retain this firm? Yes, he does. And Wirt Walker is still in charge of security when 9/11 happens.
As far as how that can happen, are people aware that those buildings were 70% empty? So every other floor in that building, in both those towers, was vacant. And there were actually some IT guys that the entire towers were powered down for the weekend before 9/11 happened. So that means all their security stuff, their cameras, everything was off. There was an IT engineer who was there, and he had to systematically shut down all their servers. And he said that he was there during the weekend, which is why he wasn't there on 9/11. He got that day off. But he said that he heard heavy equipment being drug around, and so it's he saw people coming into the building with rolling carts, et cetera, et cetera. So that was something that I always thought, well, you know, how did they do that if the building was full? But they were having trouble keeping the building full. On top of that, they were under pressure by the EPA to get all of the asbestos out of those buildings. They figured it was about $1 billion cost to get the asbestos out. So by the buildings falling down, it just did it on its own. And he insured the buildings.
Separate insurance policies, two separate.
Yeah.
Specifically for terrorist activity and planes hitting buildings. Jeb Bush was also involved in security on
right.
Building 7, which Building 7 was a very, very high secure building. CIA, Secret Service, FBI, Governor's Office, Mayor's Office. I mean, just ridiculous, that whole thing.
Well, the SEC was there, Secret the Service.
So, when but, the building goes down,
he made $4.5 billion on a $13 million investment.
$4 billion.
So that's like you investing $13 and making $4,500.
Now,
so.
An interesting note right now that's going on is there's actually in court being discussed, there's a lawsuit. Larry Silverstein is suing United Airlines and American Airlines. He's suing those airplanes for the planes hitting this building. This is after. This is open dialogue and is being discussed in court.
Yeah.
And those United Airlines and American Airlines are saying, those weren't our planes that hit the building. That's being discussed in open testimony in court right now. But of course, it's not...
Not covered.
It's not covered, but however, there's huge, huge...
Yeah, come I mean, on, you, that's if, a conspiracy if you
do,
theory.
If you do research, there's so much...
There's so much more.
So much.
Another comment on that question?
Yeah, there's a lot there. Just reading from Joel Skousen's World Affairs brief, which is always exciting if you like depressing reading. Further evidence of the switch in the air was that the last airliner to hit the World Trade Center, which South Tower, showed a large bulging modification on its belly. No airline pilot who has done a walk-around inspection of his aircraft would have accepted that aircraft with such a huge modification. Okay, so the point before that was that at least two of the hijacked aircraft, according to radar tracking records, made a rendezvous with another aircraft and switched places before turning back east and south to their targets. While it's not uncommon for aircraft to converge at different altitudes on radar tracks, you never see both aircraft execute a complete U-turn after rendezvous, as each of these did, indicating the switch in the aircraft, and that's why two of the hijacked and destroyed aircraft serial numbers were still flying in the system a couple of years after 9/11.
Okay. Next question. And this is a little bit off topic, but it ties in. What research, if any, have you done into the Saudi Arabian connection between 9/11 and the Boston Marathon bombings? Anyone?
There is no connection?
I don't know. Yeah, okay, so we'll go to the next question.
The U.S. contractors that are over in Saudi Arabia pulled off both actions.
Okay, here's one. how does knowing this information about 9/11 relate to my life as a Latter-day Saint and my mission to spread the gospel? In other words, why should I use my time, mind, resources, studying, and knowing and spreading this? Okay, well, that's a valid question. Let's cut him some slack.
Coming from a non-LDS person.
The Joe is not LDS.
Doctrine and Covenants 123:13. Ether 8.
Joe?
Gentleman 6.
Joe,
sorry.
Why don't you read it to him?
Well, that you should waste and wear out your life in bringing these things of darkness to light.
Hidden things of darkness.
Stop interrupting me. And it's out of Ether 8, you know, you kind of combine them, but, you know, and suffer not that these murderous combinations should get above you. Let no man count these as small things, for much lieth in futurity pertaining to the saints in regards to these things. For if you should suffer these things to be, the sword of justice of the Almighty God will fall upon you to your own destruction and death. Sounds like a pretty good reason.
Wow. I don't think we need to add anything else to that, do we?
You're not LDS?
No, Joe's not LDS.
You gotta
put
Mormon?
He only has the Doctrine and Covenants.
Have you ever seen that before? Doctrine and Covenants quoted by a non-member to an LDS audience. That is, I mean... There is a God in heaven. All right. Amen, brother. All right.
Did Jack cover 88, 78 through 82? Because I know in his book he talked a little bit about that.
How about we do that in part two? Can we do it? Come back to that? We got a couple more questions, and then what we're going to do... Well, let's go do the last couple questions here first. Any other questions in the jar, Brian?
No.
Okay. Well, all right. Number this question here. Please address the breaking news. This actually came out yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. Of nuclear warheads being taken off the... Which base was it? Dias. Because I can't read this writing here either. In West Texas, and it was possibly, at least the alleged, the person that was there said that they were shipped to South Carolina. Oh, and what did Senator Lindsey Graham say today? You remember that? Did anybody catch that on InfoWars or anything? Okay. He's the same day, actually it was less, but several hours later, without knowing... The word was out about nukes, said, quote, nukes are in the hands of terrorists, and there's a high alert issued for South Carolina in the Charleston area. So they're talking now, Lindsey Graham, talking, well, you know, we could have a terrorist attack, a nuclear weapon go off in South Carolina. And, of course, they're alleged to have come out of West Texas. And that's very interesting. And Joe's got a probably good take on this because he worked in that operation, so to speak, at least peripherally. And then here's the question then, the second part of that. Is our government planning to false flag us with a nuke attack and then blame it on the terrorist? And by the way, before Joe goes there, remember the memo that came out from the former state senator from South Dakota, forget his name now, who leaked that there's a whole bunch of Homeland Security and FEMA orders that are supposed to be filled by October 1st. Some of you got that email from me and other places. Now, that could be... That could be because they're trying to get it done before the end of the fiscal year. Okay, yeah, we can go with that, maybe. Or they could be planning something. It was like $11 million in vaccines and, I mean, all kinds of MREs and stuff had to be into the FEMA Region 3 by October 1st. I'm not saying anything, but it's something you need to be aware of. And, of course, Lindsey Graham's out spouting about it, and there's some missing nuclear weapons from the base in West Texas. Joe?
Well, if anybody remembers the summer of 2007 when the FBI was basically saying, oh, we know terrorists have between 5 and 6 nuclear weapons and that they're probably going to set them off somewhere in the United States, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, and so you had... Now, I can tell you one thing about nuclear weapons. They are so incredibly heavily controlled, it's almost nauseating. You're not even allowed to be in presence of documents that deal with nuclear weapons by yourself. Everything you do has to be signed. Every area you go into, you sign in, you sign out. It's almost ridiculous how heavily they're controlled. Now, in August of 2007, there was a B-52 that came out of Minot Air Force Base, and it had 6 cruise missiles on it, basically that had warheads. Now, there was no paperwork on those warheads. In other words, they were on those planes... accidentally.
Oops.
And it just happened to be, you know, the FBI is saying, oh, they have between 5 and 6 weapons. So what happened at that point was you had a very astute weapons officer who noticed that the missiles didn't have the dummy warheads that they were armed. And he reported it and was told basically shut up and mind your own business. And he went public with it because the base commander wouldn't do anything. So then the Air Force was forced to come in and do a big investigation. But the long and short of that was it looked very much like they were planning on a possible false flag at that point, and because it spread so fast through the public, they didn't do it. And that's the critical thing. I don't know. The only thing I've read about the dais, nuclear weapons, dais is a storage base, so they tend to mothball nukes there. I don't know about the credibility of the person who said that they've been shipped out, but I found it was very interesting that you see a report that says that weapons have been shipped out of Dyess Air Force Base with no paperwork, no paper trail, and suddenly we have a senator, a very pro-war senator, warning us that the terrorists have nukes and are going to use them. So,
if you go back in history a little bit, go back to World War II, and you have the case of George Racy Jordan, and some of you are familiar with Major Jordan's diary, where he talked about Great Falls, Montana, and giving so much nuclear and atomic, at that time, weaponry and secrets to the Russians. We really never knew what happened with that, except that the Russians were able to, within 2 years following our explosion of the bomb in Hiroshima, able to do their own test. And people said how amazing they could gain that kind of knowledge so quickly. And, of course, it's because we gave it to them. We do know, I don't know where that statement is right now, but in my mind, I'm listening to an individual who is a former general who makes a statement that the Russians are notoriously inept at taking care of their bombs. That they simply lose them, and they really can't track them to know where they are. Suitcase bombs are quite prevalent, and we knew they do exist. Who has them? We don't know. We do know that they do exist, however. If you come here to Utah and become quite local, Deseret Chemical is now in the process of dismantling nuclear weaponry. We say they're outdated, and therefore we want to destroy them. We aren't really sure we're getting all of them there, but that's why we moved out of Tooele County. Anyway, so with that.
Thank you. Okay, one last question here. A lot of people are saying that this whole Syria thing is just a distraction, and it may be, to get the administration out of hot water with the, you know, IRS gate and Fast and Furious and Benghazi and, I mean, NSA, the Verizon, Edward Snowden, I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on, scandal after scandal after scandal. So it may be that this whole thing is to get our attention over there while they completely implode the dollar and collapse, you know, whatever, and keep us away from the scandal. However, this seems to be more legit than that. Here's the question from someone in the audience. Is Syria about taking out the Middle East and then circling Russia for a third world war at this point? Short answers, and we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, let me just read this very quickly, which I think might answer some of that. There's a man who wrote about Bilderberg key objectives, Michael Palazzo, and in describing what was going on, he said, there's a state of perpetual imbalance will be artificially achieved by manufacturing crises that will put people under continual duress, physically, mentally, financially, and emotionally. Too tired and strung out to decide on their own destinies, populations will be confused and demoralized to the extent that faced with too many choices, apathy on a massive scale will result. And what you're bringing out here are what if, what if, what if. And I suspect a lot of those what ifs have some validity to them. However, we get tied down in the what ifs, and we tend to lose it after a while because there's just so much to think about.
What book is that?
Chapter 6, Convergence, Blue Book.
Thank you.
Woo! Yeah. Another comment, Dan?
Yeah. See, the powers that be, and it is the powers that be, it is they. We don't know exactly who it is. Because, see, if you want to maintain control over a large empire, and that's what we have, you have to divide and conquer. You can't have the people recognize who the true enemy is. So if you're a banker, or you're the moneyed interest, or whatever you are, you lend money to two kings. Otherwise, it's off with your head. And you've got to keep the populace and those participants in the secret combination in fear. And there's a lot of fears. Some of them are rational. Some of them are irrational. One of the questions is, are we going to get nuked? Yeah, we're definitely going to get nuked at some point. The question is going to be, who does it? Will we even know? There are other possible calamities that might occur. There might be a biological pandemic. A pandemic flu, a swine flu, a bird flu, maybe a lizard flu, something, some sort of an animal flu is going to catch on here pretty soon. There may be an alien attack. Okay? If we were scared enough of alien attacks, they would amp that up.
I saw that movie.
Yeah. They will amp it up. If you've seen the movie Oblivion, there's an inverted pyramid that shows up in 2017. That may be why. I'm not kidding. They might actually say that they've found some object in outer space. Maybe it's an asteroid. But anyone who understands how to work in darkness, how to murder and get gain, is going to use fear to induce the reaction that they want. And they will always need a conflict between two people. Otherwise, it's off with their head. When the people figure out who it is that's really oppressing them, they take care of business. You may have seen Disney's movie. It's not Disney. Is it Pixar? The ants. Or was it Bug's Life? I can't remember. Bug's Life. The ants finally realize they can get rid of the grasshoppers. You've all seen that. That's actual reality right there. We as a people need to get over our fear. There's a guy named Frank Herbert that wrote a book called Dune and a series on this, and he has this great quote in there. I'm going to read it to you. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. When the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. I believe really that in this world that there are only two emotions. There's fear and there's love. And Yoda says it in Star Wars. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. He says it a lot better than me. But fear not. Perfect love casteth out all fear. That's why Mormon, in the Book of Mormon, would be recommending that we pray with all the energy of our hearts for charity, for the pure love of Christ, because perfect love casteth out all fear. We, those of us that we speak with, need to gain that pure love. We need to get rid of our fear. We need to not base our actions in fear. We need to not allow irrational fears or revenge, the feeling for revenge, to overcome us so that we will act preemptively, precipitously, erroneously, and wrongly and immorally.
All right, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen.